It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. Of course, brought to you by Harvell and Collins. And I do want to remind you, do not hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050, 252-726-9050. Or you can go online to harvellandcollins.com. And as I always like to remind you, please spell out the word AND, A-N-D, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, good afternoon, Cecil. Good afternoon, Wes.
Lockwood, Wes and I today are going to talk about some of the ramifications, if you will, rules, regulations, details concerning the power of attorney. Mm-hmm. There really is a lot of confusion in our sector about the power of attorney. And so let's kind of talk about it. I know we've talked about it in the past, but It is worthy of some review. We begin, Lockwood, with the understanding that each and every one of us have legal capacity. Mm-hmm. We are able to make decisions on behalf of ourselves and our family. We're able to sign our deeds. We're able, with identification, to go into the bank accounts and alter our banking relationships. We're able to make investment decisions with our investment brokers, all based on either, you know, again, good identification, driver's license, passport, et cetera, and now, of course, even phone recognition or voice recognition. Mm. The bottom line is that we are able to make decisions for ourselves, sign our tax returns, settle our lawsuits when we're involved in accidents, things of this nature. Well, if for some reason we as an individual are in an accident or have a sudden illness or just due to declining health are unable now to handle these many, many legal issues that we all are confronted with that we really, Lockwood, take for granted, don't we? Mm-hmm. Then we need an agent under a legal document known as a power of attorney to have the authority to do all of those things that I mentioned and more under a signed document known as a power of attorney. Now, some of our listeners know the word and hear the word durable. That just simply means that the document is valid and is enforceable during the duration of our incapacity. It continues to act in a steady way until such time as maybe it's altered or amended or revoked, something of that nature. And that's where that word durable comes from, meaning it just continues indefinitely during the duration. This document is signed at a time that we are confident and able to sign legal documents. Many times when we sign a last will and testament, the attorney at that time will also generate a power of attorney for the client to sign. But one of the important issues is that the grant of authority, each and every grant of authority, the right to sign at the bank, to change investments, to alter the title to our vehicles, to alter the title to our land and our home and our real property, to change the title to our mobile home. All of those kinds of grants of authority now, Lockwood, need to be very specific, very detailed in what we're giving our agent the right to do, because the listener on the other side of that document, who's going to honor that document in 2025, is concerned about liability. They're concerned about fraud. They're concerned about the viability of the document, and they immediately, as they should, question the document. And if it is some vague grant of authority that isn't very clear, then of course the bank or the investment firm, the stock company, the DMV, the registered deeds, they're going to then question the authority of the agent. And this, of course, sends the agent into our law firm and other law firms to get legal advice and to straighten out this amount of confusion that exists. So if our listeners see the short form off of the internet, mm-hmm, or right, something that they can print and just initial here and initial there, that is most likely, Lockwood, not going to be sufficient in the day and age and circumstances that we now live in, again, the grants of authority have to be very detailed and very specific. There are some stock companies, and many, quite a few of them, that even have their own special language that they want to see in the power of attorney in order to accept the legality of it and to alter the stock account or to make investment changes relative to a portfolio, things of that nature. The document is signed at the time that the client is in a law office, hopefully, getting good, sound legal advice. Mm-hmm. And then another detail, Lockwood, is that it must be recorded in the register of deeds or in a register of deeds at the time that the document becomes, at the time that the agent begins to use the document. And the purpose here primarily is to give the public, through the recording statute, notice of the fact that the agent is the agent under the document, has the authority to do those things that are enumerated in the document. And so the public notice statutes come into play with regard to that recordation.
You know, Cecil, one thing that you've touched on, and I think this is important, and you've alluded to it several times, and that is the issue of security, accountability, and not only on the part of the individual who's going to be granted the authority, but you touched on a very big issue, banks and financial institutions, and my goodness, Internet services, they're going to be very demanding. And I'm wondering, do they have at times their own documents that you seek out? For example, you ask the agency, mm-hmm. let's say a stock company, okay, mm-hmm. do you have a power of attorney specifically? We have this, we need to establish this. Do they have their own separate documents, for example?
They do. They wow. do. And I'm dealing with that. That's one of the reasons that this topic entered my thoughts this morning is because I'm dealing with the file right now for a very wonderful client who is in that situation where her stock company is reviewing all of our documents per the advice of her money manager, if you will, or her financial planner, and they have some very specific language that they want added in the power of attorney. And so we are incorporating wow. that language into the power of attorney for the sake of this particular client under these circumstances. So, yes. Also, I think that our listeners are tuned in to and have had experience, some of our listeners, with regard to their companies that just send you their dot. Fidelity, you know, not to single out any one right. particular company, but I know that there are certain financial holding companies, if you will, advising companies that do have a specific document that they choose to send to their clients for them to sign, naming an agent. And those documents are just fine, and those are good. And we like to have those in our file. But that doesn't mean that we don't need this general power of attorney, if you will, that is very detailed and very competently drafted by our law firm and other good law firms, you know, for the sake of the client. Because the document for Fidelity, let's say, is isolated to just particularly that company, mm-hmm. and we want to have something more general in nature than that.
Okay.
Now, I want to move over a minute, Lockwood, and let Wes chime in, because the other aspect of this of these powers of attorney, Lockwood, is that, you know, we are not, under a power of attorney, we are not dealing with our own assets. As I started out the program about all of us are competent, we have the right to do this and that and whatever. Well, if all of a sudden we're not and an agent is acting on our behalf, then they have to act in what is called a reasonable person standard and in our best interest. They have to be very careful about self-dealing. They have to be careful about conflicts of interest. They have to be careful about commingling. They have to keep very accurate records. And so we're called upon at our office many times during any given week to just give guidance to an agent under a power of attorney. Just yesterday, I have a brother and a sister, and the brother is concerned about what the sister is doing under the power of attorney and called and is seeking some advice on that, and it looks like that we may have to have a meeting on that file to make sure that these issues are in check, because the sister, to use this particular file, you know, has to be acting in a reasonable manner with regard to her mother's funds. She cannot be commingling those with her own funds, and she needs to be keeping very accurate records. And these files many times end up over with Wes, don't they, Wes? And Wes, let me let you chime in and talk about this accountability and transparency issue.
You know, obviously we're dealing with a power of attorney when someone can't make decisions for themselves. You know, it can be as simple as, you know, paying someone's bills. You know, obviously if someone is, you know, it could be someone that's deployed. It could be someone that is, you know, out of the country for a period of time, and we're just needing to take care of their situation here. But in most situations when we're using a power of attorney, it's because the person has advanced to a point where they can't really handle their affairs anymore. They can't maintain their financial obligations, you know, pay their bills, you know, those type things. Could be we're using the power of attorney because they have advanced to a point where they are needing to go into long-term care, and there's some additional asset or some asset protection that needs to be done so we don't lose what we've worked so hard for our whole life. If we have the appropriate language, we can do that. In the context of, you know, litigation, if the power of attorney has the appropriate language in it, which most do, then the agent under the power of attorney would be able to defend litigation or prosecute, you know, litigation. It could be, as Cecil said earlier, a personal injury case, or it could be, you know, a breach of contract case, or it could be, you know, in any type of litigation matter. We would have the authority to act, you know, through, as the attorney, through the agent under the power of attorney. Mm-hmm. From an ethical standpoint, you know, the rules of professional conduct really dictate everything that we do as attorneys, and obviously we have to adhere to those very closely, and we take those very, very, very seriously at our law firm. And you know, one of the things that we're often told, and as I communicate with ethics counsel at the state bar when I have questions regarding ethical issues, to make sure that I'm staying, you know, directly within the lines on everything, is that, you know, we have the authority to act specifically as directed by the agent under the power of attorney. And that is our client, basically. I mean, really, the client is the principal. But if someone shows up with a valid power of attorney and they hire us and we accept the representation, then every direction that we're given from that agent is that's the direction that we're supposed to take. Mm-hmm. So they're basically acting exactly as though the principal is. Now, as it relates to the obligation to do everything properly, well, there are some guardrails up in the statutes with regard to powers of attorney. You can't take a power of attorney and go alter someone's existing estate plan, for example.
Right.
Let's say that, you know, the principal has two children and has a will and set up for a period of time, but really not even a long period of time. It's just set up where he's left everything equally to the two children, but he's named one of the two children his agent under the power of attorney. Well, let's say that that agent in one of the two children goes and changes, you know, either by deed or by changing account designation, so everything is directed to just that child, to leave out their brother or sister. Well, that is something you cannot do with the power of attorney. So that's a statutory, you know, restriction on use of a power of attorney. That's specific in the North Carolina General Statutes. Moreover, you know, just generally dealing with assets, well, you have to be careful about self-dealing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to use the power of attorney for purposes of, you know, benefiting yourself. Now, I mean, there may be certain circumstances where obviously maybe you're providing care to your parent, and maybe the parent has enough wherewithal to say, you know, you need to be compensated for taking care of me. Well, under those circumstances, something like a reasonable compensation would be fine, but we would also want what's called a caregiver agreement.
Right.
So that there's an actual contract signed indicating, you know, what care is being provided, how much you're paying, and it needs to be commercially, you know, reasonable amounts. This is all just common sense. This is just, you know, don't overstep your bounds. You know, mm-hmm. do things with transparency in dealing with the power of attorney. You know, don't try to deceive. Don't try to take advantage of other people. Don't try to alter estate plans. Don't deal, if you can avoid it, with cash, because cash is difficult to trace. Act as though when you're acting through the power of attorney that at some point in time a court, a judge, someone is going to see exactly everything you did. Now, in most cases, that's not going to be the case. But if you act in that way and you think through the way you're doing things and you do things transparently, then the likelihood that, you know, it's ever going to be called into question, you know, goes down considerably. Because a lot of times when you're dealing with the use of a power of attorney and you're dealing with someone who has misused a power of attorney, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Mm-hmm.
And where we normally get into that situation, Lockwood, is that, you know, let's say that we're representing someone who has questions about the use of a power of attorney. Well, what's our logical first question to the person who's been using the power of attorney? Well, to provide the bank statement,
all the
provide
documents.
Transparency, to provide records, to provide an accounting. And if they're forthcoming with regard to that, and they provide that information to us, and everything checks out, we're good to go, and
right.
we keep on trucking, as they say. However, if they won't provide that information to us, well, there's probably a reason. It's probably because they've helped themselves. That's my experience anyway. And then what do we do? Well, maybe we spin off into a litigation posture where we can subpoena records and find out exactly how the person has used the power of attorney. So huge responsibility. Transparency is A number one. But powers of attorney are incredibly important as well, I would mention, because if you don't have an appropriate power of attorney and you need one, but you're in a position where your condition has worsened to the point where you don't have the capacity to either to enter one, or you've been in an accident and therefore you're not cognitively, you know, aware of what's going on, and we don't have that, but there's things that we need to do for you, then we're forced into a legal proceeding, which is kind of quasi-litigation, which is called a petition for adjudication of incompetence and appointment of a guardian. Much more expensive process to go through that than to, I say simply, and it is kind of a simple process, an inexpensive process, to put a proper power of attorney in place, just as part of your standard, you know, bank of documents for your estate plan with your will, healthcare power of attorney, living will, and then a HIPAA authorization. So very important to have them. It's been very important to, as I've said, stay within the lines and if you're acting as the agent under the power of attorney.
Okay, I have a couple of questions.
Lockwood, a couple of more things
okay.
before we have to conclude that are common mm-hmm. questions. First of all, a power of attorney is a written document, as we've discussed, and it needs to be recorded in the register of deeds of any county, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually recorded in the county where the principal or the person who signed the power of attorney resides. But sometimes they, you know, counties will change. We have, you know, people from Raleigh that are retiring here permanently. Right. And, you know, had a gentleman in yesterday who has moved here, you know, from the Greensboro area and has moved to Beaufort, had a power of attorney from Guilford County.
Right.
And it was recorded in Guilford County. That's fine. He's now living here in Carteret County. The bottom line here is that the power of attorney is effective until usually two things occur. Number one is that it's modified, and a power of attorney is modified, amended, if you will. A new agent is appointed, revoked, changed by a subsequent power of attorney,
mm-hmm.
very similar to a will. So it, the last power of attorney standing, if you will, is the official power of attorney. And if it's been recorded, then it needs to be, the new document needs to be recorded over the older document so that the public knows what is the last standing document.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that I'm making here is for our listeners to know is that you can change your power of attorney. You can alter it. You can modify it. You can change the appointments from one son to a different son, from a daughter to a sister, whatever you choose to do, but you are going to need to have a new written document generated and signed that clearly modifies the prior existing document. So that's the first way that a power of attorney becomes not effective, is that it simply gets changed.
Right.
It gets revoked with a subsequent written document. The second thing that listeners know but get befuddled by constantly is that when we die, the moment that we die, a power of attorney no longer has any validity in the state of North Carolina. And if you think about that for a moment, it makes perfect sense. A principal cannot continue to grant an authority to someone, to an agent, when they're no longer living. So the power of attorney is revoked at death. The executorship at that point, Lockwood, takes over. If you are the power of attorney on a bank account or a stock account, or you're in the process of changing something, we've had situations where we're in the middle of selling a property, closing attorneys all ready to happen, and then the principal dies, the power of attorney is no longer going to be a valid document with valid authority. We're going to have to look to the estate and see who is now the executor. And so a power of attorney can be changed by a subsequent document, and a power of attorney is revoked at death. These are two very important issues that get talked about at our office a lot.
How does a power of attorney compare to that of an executor? And you've shared that with, you've explained that to us. Okay, so upon the death of the principal, there's no longer a need for a power of attorney for all intents and purposes, and it automatically falls to the executor to handle. That was question one. The other, and I've got two other quick questions for you before we wrap things up. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about powers of attorney. And the next question goes to the topic of expense. In the case of a power of attorney, and if, let's say, there is a challenge to the principal, and yet the principal is not able to conduct the business for any variety of reasons, but there needs to be a handling of this particular challenge, a court case, for example. Obviously, the person who is the power of attorney is going to have to dedicate time and effort to that. How are they, in fact, compensated for that? Or are they compensated? What's the procedure for that?
Well, there's two possibilities.
Okay.
Number one is that the document itself outlines the compensation to be generated on behalf of the agent.
Okay.
So there's a compensation provision in the power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to, of course, govern what the agent would be paid. Okay. If there is no compensation provision, then the state of North Carolina, as one would expect, our great state with its great seal, correct, Lockwood?
Right. Yeah.
We have now statutes and case law that tell the agent, what they are able to, how they're to be compensated and what that compensation is to be. And, of course, also there's case law that indicates that the agent would be reimbursed for expenses, of course, if there are things that they pay on behalf of the principal, an appraisal fee or a transfer fee or a recording fee or even a lawyer fee. If they pay any of that on behalf of the principal, then case law in North Carolina supports that they would be reimbursed. So the best procedure is for the document itself to have a compensation provision. But if it doesn't have a compensation provision, then the statute of North Carolina begins to give us some guidelines. Right. But the answer to your question, Lockwood, is that absolutely we do not, the state of North Carolina is not going to allow, is not going to encourage, if you will, or allow an agent to fall into a deep financial hole because they've stepped up to the plate and assisted a principal. They're going to allow the agent to be reasonably compensated and to be reimbursed for reasonable expenses.
Okay. And the other question I had has to do with joint ownership. Say, for example, a husband and wife jointly own a home, and of course we have the issue of a power of attorney. In that case, is a power of attorney necessary, and should it be transferable back forth or transactional across husband to wife, wife to husband? What happens to those situations where there is joint ownership, and in the case of a power of attorney?
Well, the power of attorney, the document for the principal is only going to be able to have authority over the, let's say if it were the husband, over the husband's interest in the property. Just because the husband has a power of attorney to his son or whoever, doesn't mean that the son can change the title on behalf of the wife. I mean, the wife is an independent person, separate and distinct from the husband. So each of them would need their own respective power of attorney and their own respective agent. Sometimes it's the same. Now, the other part of your question maybe you were asking is it many times each other that a husband appoints a wife appoints a husband? And the answer to that question is absolutely. Although, again, I mentioned this client yesterday who was in the office very specifically over the fact that his wife is very sick, and he's very concerned. He himself in his 80s, and if for some reason anything happened to him, his wife would not be able to handle the agency under the power of attorney, and so he will not appoint his wife. He will now go and appoint his son as the power of attorney, or his daughter, or whoever he tells me to put in the document. But he cannot appoint his wife because his wife just simply is now at a point in her medical life where she's going to be unable to be the agent under a power of attorney. She's also unable to be the executor under a will. So he's in our office updating these things because of just life issues.
You know, that's a
You asked kind of two questions there. I think Lockwood, did I answer them?
Oh, you did, very much so. And you actually,
but just because the property's joint, I mean, that was where you went, were going several times, doesn't mean that one of the joint owners' agent, one of them, can change the joint ownership. They can only change the ownership of their respective principal.
Gotcha.
And we have this happen a lot where property is joint, husband and wife, and we're wanting to transfer the property to, let's say, a trust. Mm-hmm. Well, the husband is able to sign his document, but the wife, even though the property's joint, tenants by entirety, the wife is unable to sign. She is, you know, in the nursing facility.
Right.
She is not doing well at all. She's not able to come into the office. And so we need her power of attorney, don't we, Lockwood?
Okay.
So we have two signatures on that document, don't we? We have the husband signing on behalf of himself. And then we have the husband signing as agent for his wife, who was unable to come into the office.
Uh-huh.
But he is signing as her agent under the power of attorney. But the point is that we have two signatures because it was jointly owned. We're going to have to treat them separately. Do we have the husband's signature? Do we have the wife's signature?
That is an interesting hook. I really appreciate you bringing that up, Cecil. Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins, and of course Wes Collins with us as well. We've been talking about the issue of powers of attorney, and you touched on a few items there which we don't have time to get to, but the other HIPAA powers of attorney, there are a variety of POAs or powers of attorney that I think we look forward to a longer conversation about. I want to thank both of you for your time today. Again, Harvell and Collins, spell out the word and if you're looking for them on the internet, Harvell and andcollins.com. And don't hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050. You're touching on a very important topic, Cecil and Wes, that I think our audience needs to keep in mind because we are all getting older. We need to be prepared. Thank you both for your time today. Appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Let's talk legal on the Talk Station.